Our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org.
I'm here with Dr. Larry Brilliant, and he's the author of a memoir, Sometimes Brilliant. And Larry, I know that that Maharaji gave you the assignment, the preposterous assignment of joining a team of people to eradicate smallpox in India. And I just want to say a bit about smallpox, because I know that you have this also in your book, and I've gotten this from there, that you do a comparison. You say, like, in the 20th century, if you just take that 20th century, those 100 years, maybe 150 or 200 million people died from a combination of wars, genocide, and disease. So that's pretty big. All right. But then you also talk, in that same period of time, 500 million people died of this horrible, horrible disease, smallpox. And your guru suggested, here's the last bastion in the world of smallpox in this populous country that is just, it's not well organized in some ways, if I may say that. And he's saying it will be eradicated and you will be part of it. Okay, so let's hear a bit about this impossible. I think of, like, Persephone, or is it Psyche? Psyche getting, you know, she's having to sort the seeds overnight, it's like a fairy tale or a myth that this can happen. Can you help us understand?
You know, one of the things I think about is, when you and I, Justine, came to San Francisco just around the summer of love in the 1960s, every year 3 million people died from smallpox. During those days that we were cavorting at Haight Ashbury, and that kind of puts it into perspective how little we knew about the rest of the world, and particularly the last home of smallpox, these four countries that in 1972... remained with smallpox: India, Bangladesh, Nepal, Pakistan. They had something called variola major. There was another kind of smallpox, variola minor, that probably infected as many people, but only killed 1 out of 100. Variola major, killer smallpox, killed 1 out of every 3 who got the disease. During the time I was in India, there were 250,000 children who got smallpox. And it was a terrible, words failed me then and they fail me now. But you would see children, sometimes we would drive into villages and our Jeep had a big official looking United Nations seal on it. And sometimes mothers would come up to me and bring me a baby and push that baby into my arms and say, "Doctor, UN doctor, heal my baby." And if the baby was still alive, there was nothing that you could do.
Once the disease was contracted,
there's hardly anything even to give comfort. I mean, there was no medicine in the villages, or no emergency rooms, no ambulances. And most of the time when I was given that baby and put into my arms, the baby was already dead. And that happened so many times that those images of those children have merged in my memory into a continuous graph of suffering. And there was one place, one railway station that I went into called Tatanagar, where there were dozens of bodies stacked like cords of wood. And children, I mean, it looked like a scene out of Hieronymus Bosch painting or Dante's Inferno. And I was 28 or 29 and way over my head. And it was, you said it was improbable. It was improbable that I could ever be hired by the United Nations. I was in my mid-20s. I had never had a job, except I graduated from medical school and done an internship. I immediately ran away with the circus, the hog farm. And I had no training other than that. And the World Health Organization and the UN only hired professors. So I was younger by two decades than most of the people that I work with. They were all delegated, deputed, the UN calls it, from the Center for Disease Control, CDC, or NIH, or the Mirnkova Laboratory in Russia. I'm the only person in the history of the United Nations whose papers said deputed from the Hanuman Monkey Temple in the Himalayas. I'm very proud of that, actually.
There's a story I just want you to tell, because it's so amazing that you're talking about being in
Tatanagar, the city of the Tatas.
Okay. And you go to the health official and you see that he's just sitting there in his library alphabetizing his books when all of these bodies that you describe are piled up, like just the horrible devastation of it. And I call it righteous anger, righteous anger. You got really this youngster, because really you're not even 30 yet, and you decide to, I'm going to go to the top guy and I'm going to find out what's going on, and he's going to know the truth about the way that this disease is being spread out from this train station all over India. And so if you can describe that story of knocking on the door of one of the high officials of this, it's like a Pittsburgh town. It's a company town.
It is, and actually, it was built by Kaiser Steel, and the colony where many of the executives live was called the Kaiser Colony. American engineers had come there to help build it, and I was righteously indignant. I was also young and impetuous and kind of dumb, but I didn't know what to do. There were 2,000. Cases of smallpox in this one town, which is smaller than San Francisco. And they said that the rivers were not run because of the bodies that had been put into the rivers. And it was horrible. And I couldn't contact WHO. I didn't have a phone, or there was no. And I knew that that hundreds of these young men who had come to this Pittsburgh of India, Tatanagar, were coming there because they could get a job there. They could work in the steel mills. They could work in the coal mines. But they didn't get to do that job. They sat next to somebody who had smallpox. 2 weeks later, they contracted smallpox. They found themselves sicker than they'd ever been in their life. They were young, unemployed men, and they were all men. And when they got that sick, they only had one thing in mind, which was to go home to die. So they'd go to the railway station. Sometimes they would die at the railway station. But if they didn't, they would get on a train and they would take that disease back to their towns and reseed it all throughout India and Bangladesh and Nepal and the neighboring countries. And I knew I had to stop it, but I didn't have any real authority. The WHO role was a consultative role. But I was really mad and young and impetuous. And I asked, who is the head of the city? And they said, well, there is no head of the city. I said, well, who's the head of the Tatas? And they said, well, the biggest Tata company here is called Tata Iron and Steel. And the head of that is named Rusi Modi. I said, where does he live? And no one knew. And I just assumed he would have to live in the Kaiser Colony. And I went with my paramedical assistant, who was really my smallpox guru, Zafar Hussain, and we went door to door in the Kaiser Colony. We looked crazy. And where is Rusi Modi? And we were told where his house was. And by the time we got there, it was midnight. And I went up to the door of the CEO of the largest company in India, and I pounded on his door, and his butler opened the door and said, come back, you can't see anybody tonight. And I pounded again. And they let me in, and two big dogs came up to me and grabbed one each of my hands and held me there. And Rusi Modi, wearing pajamas, came up and he had been eating dinner. They ate dinner very late in India. And he looked at me and says, "Who the hell are you? What do you want? What are you doing in my house? It's midnight." He made a lot of sense. But I said, "Your company is spreading death all over India." "What are you talking about?" I said, "You're exporting smallpox. You're not exporting steel. You're exporting smallpox everywhere in India." He said, "What are you talking about? I said, "There's smallpox. There are people dying in your city and you don't know it." He said, "Who the hell are you?" And I said, "I'm a WHO medical officer." I didn't look like one. I know I didn't look like one.
You were pretty young, scruffy.
And he said, "Well, wait a minute. Come sit, have dinner with us." And when I said that, WHO medical officer, and there's smallpox, you're exporting death. And he had me sit down with the person he was eating dinner with, was Sujit Gupta, who became my closest friend in India. And in the end, the Tatas, who I thought of as this demonic capitalists, thinking of my own experience back in the 60s.
Which are a group of companies.
They were the largest company in Asia at that time.
Yes.
A conglomerate. Well, they were, turns out they were Parsis. They were Zoroastrians from Persia who had immigrated into India. And they were the kindest people. They would say about themselves, "Parsi, thy name is charity." It means charity. And far from being the worst, they were the best of the companies in India. And Rusi Modi just did not know. And that's true.
They didn't know. Nobody had been able to break through
Bernie Sanders said that most of the rich people in the industrial successful cities, they just don't know what it's like for everybody else. And that was so true for the aristocracy of the Indian company. But I have to tell you that what Rusi did and his boss, J.R.D. Tata, wonderful man, what they did is they gave me what would now be the equivalent of millions of dollars, 500 jeeps, thousands of workers. They stopped exporting steel. They stopped digging coal for almost 6 weeks. And every person who was working for Tata Iron and Steel or Tata Electrical Locomotive or Tata Tube Company, they became a smallpox worker.
It's so amazing to read that story and then to hear you tell it. It's like a campaign worthy of General Patton. I mean, they just all of their resources then, and that the quick way that a company can just move it and get things done. I know how impressed you were and how much you learned in that whole process.
Well, it's why I accepted becoming the head of Google.org, and I work with Salesforce.org. Not that I'm naive about companies or the incentive for profits, but there is an ability in civil society to make a public-private partnership with governments. And this was the first one in India. They actually created a formal public-private partnership to eradicate smallpox.
I'm here with Dr. Larry Brilliant and having a brilliant conversation. He is the author of a memoir, Sometimes Brilliant. And if you want to know more about his work, you can go to his website, larrybrilliant.com. Or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions. I'm here with Dr. Larry Brilliant. He's the author of a memoir, Sometimes Brilliant. And Larry, I know that in breaking the rules and working kind of around the systems and doing the best you can, I know that there was a time that you really kind of crossed the line. And Indira Gandhi, Mrs. Gandhi, the premier of India, had to make an example, and she decided, okay, it's time to send Larry home. That's going to be my decree. And can you describe what happened there?
Well, it was at it was because of Tathanagar, and I had arranged to quarantine the city. I was so afraid of all these young people with the disease carrying it everywhere else. And the right thing to do epidemiologically is to quarantine the city. And I did that, and I stopped the trains from going. I got the superintendent of police to issue a writ, and the railway minister to issue a writ. But some of the people were very angry that a young Westerner had done that. I didn't have any right to do it. And one of the people who was told he couldn't leave the city unless he was vaccinated was a member of parliament. He called his cousin, who was the chief minister, who called Mrs. Gandhi and said, I want you to throw WHO out of India. Mrs. Gandhi had a cabinet meeting to decide whether to throw WHO out of India.
Well, that was a very serious.
That seemed a little extreme. So they agreed on what seemed like a very modest course of action, which was to throw me out of India and give me what was called a quit India notice. It would have been a minor diplomatic ripple, but everybody except me would have gotten over it. And after she had issued the quit India notice and was ending that meeting, the commissioner of health, who was called Dr. M.I.D. Sharma, really interesting. Yesterday, I got a note on Facebook from his daughter, and this was a man I loved so much. I used to call him Papa. And the reason I used to call him Papa, and he used to call me Sonny, was that after Mrs. Gandhi had told the minister to issue the quit India notice, M.I.D. Sharma took her aside and said, Madam Prime Minister, could I have a word with you? And she said, yes, Dr. Sharma. He was a hero. He'd won the Padma Shri. And she said, yes, Dr. Sharma, what is it? He said, Madam, you can, of course, do anything. You're Prime Minister. But before you kick Dr. Brilliant out of India, would you just delay for 3 days? And she said, well, yes, Dr. Sharma, I will. But why? And he said, because, Madam Prime Minister, if you delay 3 days, I will adopt him. Then you will not be able to kick him out of India. Well, that created quite a stir. But it led to Dr. Sharma explaining to Mrs. Gandhi that there were 250,000 children with smallpox and that she was being deceived, that things were going well, and that what I had done, although it was really unorthodox and over the top, it was because of this desperate feeling that the international community had, and most of the Indians working in the program, that if the epidemic raged out of control, more and more children would die, more exports from India would go to London and Japan, and that India would actually become quarantined and a pariah nation. And Mrs. Gandhi understood that, and she undid the quit India notice. I actually met her, but M.I.D. Sharma called me in after this confrontation and said, Larry, I think that from now on, I'm going to call you Sonny. And I said, what are you talking about? And he told me the story, and I couldn't speak, that he had offered to adopt me. But from then on, he did call me Sonny, and I called him Papa, and the program changed because Mrs. Gandhi had been confronted by this noble, wonderful man. And after we had eradicated smallpox, he wrote a book about it, and he listed the 20 reasons that we had succeeded, and they all began with the letter R. And he said, well, first was Ram, God in Hindi. The second was Rahim, which is another Arabic name for Allah. The third was the rains, which came and reduced the incidence of smallpox. And fourth was the rules and regulations. And then fifth was the routine breaking of rules and regulations.
And that's
when he said, see Larry Brilliant.
Oh, fabulous. So, I know that you were able to go to the state of Bihar and actually be with the young woman who was the last victim of smallpox, and I know you hold her in your heart, and if you can describe what that was like.
Sure. This is a young girl at that time named Rahima Banu, and it was in Bangladesh and on the island of Bola Island, which ironically was where the cyclone had hit in 1972, that was the reason we took our buses from London, carrying all this medical supply and trying to be the hippie Red Cross. And Rahima Banu was the last case of variola major. And you can't help but be with her in this tiny little village in the middle of an island in the middle of the Bay of Bengal and not think of all the people throughout history who have had smallpox and died of it, the 500 million in the 20th century, the 25 kings and queens who died of it, no matter how rich they were. We are really all in it together, especially when you're talking about a disease like smallpox.
You know, Larry, one of the themes, it seems to me, in the book goes over and over, that balance between being and doing. That's been a struggle, it seems to me, from the way that the book is written, for you and for many people that you know, that being an activist out in the world and being a spiritual person, and it's like this push and shove and warp and woof. And can you say something
sure.
about that?
You know, yoga, which we all think of when we think of people doing asanas, is a word which means to union with God. It's like unity, the Unitarians. It literally means to yoke. Yoga means to yoke, to tie your small soul, your heart, your Atman with God, the big soul. And in India, there are many different ways and practices and disciplines by which you try to merge yourself and join with God, thousands of kind of different yogas. We know one in the U.S., but there's Ashtanga Yoga and Raja Yoga and Jnana Yoga and Karma Yoga and Nishkam Karma Yoga. And my guru taught me a kind of yoga which is to work in the world to help alleviate suffering without attachment, either to the results or to yourself doing it. And he told me to go work in the smallpox program because he said that God would eliminate this one form of suffering to kind of relieve that one burden on humanity, and that my job was to try to work in my heart inside to rid myself of anger and hatred and become more equanimous in the process, offer to God the work that I did and not take credit for it or make a big deal out of it.
That reminds me of a story that after this was over, after the eradication was successful, and you ended up still kind of in turmoil because as you describe all these bodies, all these people, you hold all of these in your heart. It's like this one continuous picture of all these people who suffered. And so you ended up in a retreat with Goenka, who was one of your first meditation teachers. And you're feeling agitated yourself, but you're holding a lid on it. And Goenka said something just so beautifully when that retreat was interrupted. I'd love for us to kind of go out with that story because I think it really is significant for these times right now.
Well, the only way that I made it through the smallpox program, because my guru had died, was I would go to the churches that were there, a Jesuit church. I would go to ashrams, Buddhist vihars, Hindu temples, old Jewish community that was still in India, hang out with Sufis. And this one time, very close to the end of smallpox, we were at a Jain monastery with Goenka teaching a meditation course, and he would always chant Bevites, may all beings be happy. And he tried to teach us equanimity. And after we'd been there in silence for 7 days, a young kid broke in the back door and screamed out, Goenka, what makes you say you're so fucking pure? And he yelled at him. This was our teacher. And we were all agitated. And nothing happened. The kid left, and 2 days later, Guenca said, "You may wonder why I didn't do anything with that interruption." And he said, "Because you're here to learn equanimity. And what that young man did is he gave you a gift to teach you how to become equanimous. If you'd wanted to learn to drive a car, if he lent you his car, you would say thank you. He lent us his anger. That will teach you equanimity."
So the lesson for us and the lesson that you took away with that, does it give you optimism for the future?
Oh, I have to be an optimist. I saw the last case of killer smallpox after seeing hundreds, thousands of children die from that disease. I went from seeing this horrific Hieronymus Bosch scene to a world free of smallpox. And so quickly, and my guru in some improbable way said that that would happen and predicted it. So I believe the world is so much more interesting than we think it is. And that's what gives me absolute optimism.
Larry, I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
I've been speaking with Dr. Larry Brilliant. He's the author of a memoir, Sometimes Brilliant, The Impossible Adventure of a Spiritual Seeker and Visionary Physician Who Helped Conquer the Worst Disease in History. And if you want to know more about the work of Larry Brilliant, you can go to his website, larrybrilliant.com. Or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You've been listening to New Dimensions. This is program number 3601.
New Dimensions Radio has been making a difference on our planet since 1973, thanks to the generosity of our listeners. You too can help make a difference with a tax-deductible donation or membership. Please visit our website, newdimensions.org. And just click the donate button. You can also subscribe to our free weekly podcasts and find over 1,000 hours of audio dialogues in our searchable archive. New Dimensions is produced by New Dimensions Radio in Santa Rosa, California, USA. Our executive producer is Justine Willis-Toms. Our post-production editor is Lou Judson. For over 4 decades, New Dimensions has been producing weekly conversations at the leading edge. We sincerely thank all of you who have supported us by being members of Friends of New Dimensions, as well as members of our affiliate stations. My name is Dan Drayson. On behalf of everyone at New Dimensions, whose endeavors make this program possible, I'm wishing you well. New Dimensions Radio is an independent producer supported by listener contributions. To find out more about the program you've just heard, to subscribe to our free weekly newsletter and our New Dimensions and New Dimensions Cafe podcasts, and to access thousands of other programs in the New Dimensions archive, please visit our website, newdimensions.org. That's newdimensions.org. Or call us at 707-468-5215. That's 707-468-5215. Please join us next time as we explore New Dimensions. New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in Conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org. Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hi, I'm Dr. Judith Orloff, author of The Empath Survival Guide. Next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about life strategies for sensitive people.
If you want to explore unique perspectives that are rarely expressed in mainstream media, you are listening to the right channel. This is CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.